Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Doing well, doing good, doing great. Happy to be here, excited to be here, juiced to be here. There is something in the air. Shout out to all the dunkers. Thank you for once again embracing your bounce. And it is playoff time. It is playoff season. It is chaos time. And I should have known. As soon as Joel Embiid hit a 17-spin fadeaway and then hit a game-winning fadeaway three and started screaming at nobody in particular after Doc Rivers tried to call a timeout and Drake thought it was a stop, I should have known there was something in the air. Should have known. Now, tonight, we're recording on Thursday night. I am a DNP dance recital, so I'm trying to play catch-up on what occurred tonight. I thought I was good, folks. I saw the Minnesota 8-0 run. I was like, sweet. Then it was like 14-2. I was like, oh, we good. Comeback, chaos. It is chaos. The Grizzlies won, ? And then you have the Jazz getting booed off the court at halftime. They didn't even do a whiteout. Mike Conley got a flagrant foul. Spencer Dinwiddie dunked on Rudy Gobert. Nikias is doing this pod from the 58th floor of a palace.
Close but no cigar.
You can't deny it. There's a painting in the background that has 17 mountains. I don't make the rules.
I don't know how I feel about this narrative. I'm going to be honest. I will say, I hope you enjoyed the recital. Two, there has been a lot going on. I was able to watch the Grizzlies-Wolves game, in which I cold taped myself, which was great.
Oh, well, you said you had seen enough of Memphis.
Yeah.
Can we talk about this? Because if there's one city you don't want to get packed up in, it's that one.
Look, man, if you had seen the first half, the first 2.5 quarters even, it was just like, what is this? What is Memphis doing? Like, Ja was getting baked off the dribble by Patrick Beverley and then was also doing bad things as a help defender. And it was bad. It was bad. There was a lot of missed shots, a lot of bad offensive process for Memphis, a lot of transition for Minnesota. It just looked like the crowd was in it. That's the first home playoff game they've hosted in, 4 years? Like, the crowd was amped. Memphis looked bad. It was just all bad. And I was like, you know what? I've seen enough of Memphis. And then the second half happened, or more specifically, the fourth quarter happened. And you would have been so proud of Desmond Bane tonight.
Desmond Bane!
You would have been so proud of him. Kill shot after kill shot. Tyus Jones made big shots. Brandon Clark was cutting and grabbing boards and sprinkling in floaters and all kind. It all fell apart. And Minnesota did the thing offensively.
Let's talk about it, man. I'm going to ask you a question as far as, because the number one thing, and this is fair or unfair, I'm not sure. Side note, it must be exhausting to have to talk about basketball without actually watching basketball. Like, I just can't imagine that being, like, the way. Like, me going to the box score and being like, oh, Cat only shot 4 times. Trash. That's my take. Anyways, back to this. I'm going to rewind it to game 2 before you fill me in on game 3.
Okay.
Because it felt like game 2 was Memphis dealing a series blow and, like, a series-shifting blow in a little bit. Like, the last thing you want as a lower seed is for that higher seed to kind of figure it out. And it felt like Memphis figured a few things out in one game. Like, number one, removing Steven Adams. Shout out to him, but this wasn't his series. Offensively, you got more dynamic rollers. You got more space. Defensively, you can commit to switching. You have consistency. You know what you're doing. All that good stuff. Lessens the threat of the Edwards cat pick and roll. Yeah, Desmond Bane and Dylan Brooks showcasing, hey, if we can make plays, Minnesota's not quite as locked in on us. Let's get cooking. Little things like Memphis lowering the angle of their screens. And Minnesota's offensive process, once they made that switch, just felt bad. Didn't feel like they had the same advantages with Cat. Post-ups were doubles. Pick and roll was a switch. Anthony Edwards' game 1 was tremendous, but game 2 showed, oh, wait, they need that. And that's not where you want to be. So what happened with Minnesota?
Dude, one, it was a tale of two halves, but to the general offense point, downsizing in a way without Steven Adams' help with the mobility. We saw a lot of Kyle Anderson on Kaepernick, which was interesting to me. You still had Jaren Jackson on Jared Vanderbilt, so you could roam. We talked about that a little bit on the last podcast. And so for one, like the pick and pop wasn't as effective and those openings weren't as prevalent as we saw in the first two games. But beyond that, like Cat also didn't really get the touches you would think he would get. He got Kyle Anderson, who was a good defender, but also like there are maybe a handful of post-ups for Cat tonight, which felt odd to me considering like the bread and butter wasn't really there in terms of the openings in the pick and pop. And so you would have liked to have seen more of an emphasis to feed Cat down low. You would have liked to have seen a little bit more assertiveness with Cat. Cat was a bit frustrated with some of the foul calls tonight. Stop me if you've heard that one before. Foul troubles did stun him a little bit. And from there, we got the most aggressive D'Angelo Russell night of the series. Anthony Edwards was a guy that tried to quell the run that the Grizzlies were on, but tried to do so with jumpers, and that did not work out well, especially not as well as it did in game one. So you got a nice dose of Memphis making a defensive adjustment to take away some of the easy openings from Cat. Cat also not being assertive in his own right, and then also not being fed by his guards. And then once things got tight in that fourth quarter, it just looked like the Wolves were just kind of floundering, looking for openings, and it just didn't happen.
It's tough. That's tough. But, I mean, you got to, I guess, salute to Memphis for turning that up in the second half. Sheesh.
You do. Like it was surreal to watch. Like I can't wait to watch your game thread on this game. One, I need your reaction when you see Patrick Beverley hit a behind-the-back move on Ja.
Oh, okay. That tells me everything I need to know about where this game was at.
Yeah, I tweeted what I tweeted for a reason. Like that's how it started. Like start out with a 9-0 run, I want to say, for Minnesota. Then went to 14-2. It was bad. It was really bad.
And this is coming off some nights where we had one scene losing at home. This is fun.
Yeah, this is
gonna I know we're supposed to talk about the adjustments, but I just want to talk about these series while we can. This is the joy of the first round. Once you get to this point where you can kind of see, oh, this is what this series is about. This team is close, but they're running out of time to find this. Philly, Toronto. Toronto looks like, hey, they might squeak one. Maybe we can. Nope.
Oh, man.
Didn't do it. But yeah, let's talk about it. You lead the dance, man. I'm cutting to the dunker spot.
This is the podcast name. All right, let's actually, where do you want to go? Do we want to go Toronto, Philly? We can bounce around.
We can start there if you'd like.
All right, let's go Toronto, Philly, because that was an exhilarating game until things got tight for Toronto late in the game. And it ends with Precious Achiuwa at the free throw line. Which, why does he have the ball late to begin with? That's the thing. Two free throws, a chance to put Toronto up after blowing a small lead, and he misses both. We get overtime. It's a back-and-forth affair. You get the Joel Embiid shot. In the midst of all of this, there's no Pascal Siakam to be found because he went scoreless in the fourth quarter in overtime. Went scoreless in the second half. Which, one, give some credit to Doc Rivers. I will put my hand up. We saw
whoa. We're not speeding past that. You said what now?
Just a quick hat tip to Doc Rivers for just moving the chess pieces around defensively. It's where you got more Joel Embiid on Pascal. Also a hat tip to Tobias Harris, who has more than held his own in the Pascal matchup.
He's done his job, and that's been a huge part of it. Because now they can just put Embiid on Siakam in the second half or when they feel like things are cooking, and now it's a rhythm-type deal. So now you mix in Tobias being active, you mix in Joel Embiid helping, and now you say, hey, now Embiid's on Siakam. So now, hey, guess what? Your little Fred VanVleet screening thing doesn't work as well. You got to bring someone else up here, or you got to make Siakam a screener. And that changes the math a little bit, but continue.
Like that was huge, and Toronto's offense was pretty much in the mud from there. I would say it was nice to see Gary Trent Jr. look like himself for the first time in this series. He has been dealing with an illness on top of having his work cut out for him as a helper defensively, because it's a total team effort to try to slow down Joel Embiid. But he looked good offensively. OG Anunoby continued to knock down shots, also had some funky drives that went for him. But it just kind of came down to the stars at the end for Toronto. Fred VanVleet couldn't get going. The workload really seems like it is catching up to him at the worst time. Like, I think the knee is still bothering quite a bit. And to that point, as good of an on-ball defender as Fred VanVleet is, and with the complaints that I've had about James Harden from like a burst perspective and stuff, it is telling that James Harden is like calling for Fred VanVleet, calling for his man to screen to get VanVleet in the action and to attack.
The Raptors have not been able to solve that. And I feel like it's gotten worse by the game, where it felt like, okay, we can switch, feel comfortable. Now it's switching help. Now it's switching uh-oh. And that's not something you expected to have happen. But that's opened a lot more up for Philly. Continue.
That it has. And I was going to say that game three was really the first time it felt like the Raptors weren't selling out on Harden drives in the way they had to, the way that they had in the first two games. I was just kind of waiting to see when they were going to say, all right, James, be a scorer. Let's see it. And we saw quite a few drives in game three where Harden didn't get help thrown his way. And he got to the basket and finished. And he got a couple of those on Fred VanVleet. And I'm just like, yo, it's about time we saw this adjustment. But also, I didn't expect Fred VanVleet to be the one being attacked. Like, you would think it would be Malachi Flynn when he was out there. Or even testing out Gary Trent Jr., who Harden has had a little bit of success on. But the VanVleet matchup has been a bit problematic. And I don't know how much better that gets considering the status of his knee.
And the status of the series.
Which, three games down, that's tough. That felt like, duh, you want to win the game. It's your first home game. But also, the way that they lost that one. Because they had control of it for a large chunk of that game.
Yeah, it looked like the template of what they could do was going to be working. But you got to win that. That's the thing about the playoffs. You can do everything right that you need to do. But if you don't get the result, it just erases it. Unfortunately for Toronto, now they are in a hole they got to dig themselves out of. I expect some fight out of them in game four, but then you got to go back to Philly. Hope you can get back to Toronto. So it's going to be tough sledding, and still just no answer for Joel Embiid.
They did start Kim Birch in game three, and it went about as you would expect. Was not a fun time for Mr. Birch. But
we're not doing Kim Birch slander on the
no, we're, spot. We're not doing Kim Birch slander. I'm a fan
of making sure. Running Rebels, come on. Let's go.
Oh, there it is. There's the angle. But no, he tried his best. And also, just a quick note on Precious Achiuwa note, because I started with him missing the free throws. He had himself one heck of a game overall. Like, it was just the timeliness of those misses that really hurt. But 26 off the bench for him, had a block, knocked down a couple of threes, had some nice finishes in the game. Like, if he didn't have that at the very end, like, it's a totally different conversation. But that was just a damper on the night that he had.
It's tough. I mean, look, if Philly's going to get this version of Tyrese Maxey and Tobias Harris, they become a much tougher team to beat. And now it's going to be interesting to see, can they keep their foot on the pedal? And can they gut that out? Because game three might be a game they lose in the regular season with the way it went.
Mm-hmm.
But credit to them for battling, sticking around, and ended up getting the result. And we'll see if that boosts their confidence going forward.
That's got to be the hope for them. You did mention, like, Toronto kind of showed the template of what it would take to beat Philly in this game. Do you see any adjustments from what you saw in game three that could carry into game four?
See, I think Toronto's past – in each series, you get past the point of adjustments – and you have to just execute what works well, if that makes sense. So I don't know if there's anything else Toronto can throw out there unless they just want to go wild and play zone for more or anything like that. They just have to execute what they need to do. They need to try and double, make it tough on Embiid as they can, find a way to neutralize Harden so he's not creating so many open looks, make it tougher on Maxey, and then offensively they got to find a way to score. They have to give themselves a shot to let their defense get set and let it count in the fourth quarter like it had in the regular season. Unfortunately, it just feels like the offense goes in the mud at the worst times, and now they're in a fight that maybe they can't win. So they have to find a way to make some shots, keep the pressure on Philly, get them stagnant, bog them down, but they have to do it a lot of times in a row.
Yeah, easy peasy. Just got to hammer the good stuff home. Like, I'll say on Toronto's front, like, one thing I was looking at was, well, heading into the series, I'm like, okay, they could probably get some good stuff out of some Pascal, Fred VanVleet, inverted pick and roll. Like, one, that's a way to test Embiid in space. And two, if Tyrese Maxey's going to get that matchup, let's see how he deals with ghost screening. Let's see if they do switch that, like how that's going to look. And it just hasn't gotten as much traction as I thought it would. And that's a testament to Philly, but also, again, VanVleet just hasn't looked healthy. And if that screen isn't forcing any sort of switch, it's Siakam versus Embiid, who has more than held his own in space to this point. And just with Embiid's presence and him being more locked in defensively, you're not getting to the rim like that. And if you're not getting to the rim like that, you're not getting to the free throw line like that. It just further showcases the difficulties that Toronto's had in the half court, at least when it's mattered. Because the offense overall has been better than it was in the regular season in terms of like offensive rating. But you get into the last 3-4 minutes of the game where you just need to generate a good shot, and it has been a little bit of a struggle for him. So what y'all see, let's keep this out east. Let's go Bull Bucks.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. The Chicago Bulls took a game in Milwaukee.
That they did.
And I took my L, so I can't do a victory lap because I thought this was the matchup Chicago would want. But game two was exactly why Chicago would want that matchup. We've got shot makers that can hurt your scheme, and we can make enough of these shots to make you trip over yourself on the other end. And boy, did Milwaukee trip over themselves on the other end. Both ends, really. But can we please get my man Coach Budenholzer, championship-winning Coach Budenholzer, great coach. Can we get him some seasoning for this offense? Chicago has said, hey, you know what? We're just going to double Giannis and Drew and Chris Middleton, and we'll rotate out of it. And Milwaukee's spacing has been suspect, to say the least. You've got
poop. It has been poop.
Wow. That's, folks, if you don't know, that is some of the strongest disdain you can get from Nekias Duncan on the audio airwaves. It's been just a weird mashup. You've got your guards in the dunker spot, which I understand. I like the spacing with that. Unfortunately, it's like Zach LaVine or Patrick Williams down there, and you're gifting a rotation. Or you have Brooke Lopez spaced at the block, which allows help to come if you have Giannis at the elbow. Or you have a situation where you're small and you still have someone at the dunker spot when you should just space the floor. Or you have Javon Carter one pass away.
I don't know where to start.
Well, this is the issue. Milwaukee was able to out-talent Chicago in the regular season. But in the playoffs, there's a game plan in place. We have a mindset. This is what we're willing to give up. We've picked our poison. You have to now beat that. And now Chicago is rotating, but the rotations that they're choosing and they know are coming. Milwaukee hasn't been able to consistently put the pressure on Chicago to make them make decisions, to force them into rotations they don't want to get to, which we saw all regular season. That's how you beat Chicago's defense, force them to overhelp. They haven't been able to get there. And now, I don't want to overreact to one game, but once the template is laid out, it's there. So now Chicago knows, oh, all we got to do is get to this. So go ahead and let them know how you feel about the Bucks offense.
It was poop in game two. That's where I start.
All right. All right. Twice. Look, man,
I rewatched that game earlier today. It took all the restraint in the world to not clip every offensive possession that I had an issue with Milwaukee. Like, you touched on Javon Carter being one pass away. Like, there, I ended up doing a video on that. And I contrasted a post-up from Milwaukee versus one from Chicago. And it's just like, you run a cross screen for Giannis to force a mismatch. Like, okay, that's cool. You got Grayson Allen screening for Giannis. He's physical. He can also shoot. So if you do get the switch, you can space him, whatever, whatever, whatever. Then you got Chris Middleton clearing to the other side. Like, all right, cool. There's your skip pass if you need it. And then it's Javon Carter making the entry pass, one pass away. You have Pat Connaughton and Grayson Allen basically standing on top of each other. So, like, one bull could defend both of those guys if you wanted to, but you got two guys there. And so Giannis attacks right. He takes a, not even two dribbles, he takes a dribble and a half. The ball is on the way up after the first dribble. And Zach LaVine is doubling off of Javon Carter. I'm just like, what do you think is going to happen? Milwaukee wants to set up empty corner pick and roll with Chris and Giannis. And you have, oh, with Drew and Giannis. And you, no, it's Chris and Giannis. And you have Javon Carter one pass away. So you got Zach LaVine helping at the nail. I'm just like, what did you think was going to happen? We talked about how important it would be when we did a watch party, Celtics Bulls, in which the Celtics just blasted Chicago. We did a watch party. We were talking about how important it was for Chicago to be able to nail their rotations, for them to be in comfortable spots so they can provide help. And if they can nail those rotations and force turnovers, then they'd be in a pretty decent spot. Like, that was the template that got them to the one seed when they were healthy early in the regular season. And Milwaukee is just gifting them these rotations. They are making themselves harder to guard. They're making themselves easier to guard. And that's on top of Alex Caruso did a phenomenal job all night long defensively. Derrick Jones Jr. made plays. Patrick Williams was all over the place. Like, Chicago played well. And Milwaukee decided, we're just going to beat ourselves on both ends. The spacing was bad. Where they placed the guys, it just didn't make sense. You go middle pick and roll with Wes Matthews and Drew Holiday on the same side. You have Giannis rolling to that side. And it's just like, why? Why is this happening? And then on defense, I love Giannis. I typically have nothing but nice things to say about Giannis. For 3.5 quarters, I do not know what he was doing on defense.
I'm going to pause you there real quick.
Okay.
Before we go to their defense, point out a couple things they did well offensively. They did a couple things well. Giannis's passing was incredible. Mm-hmm. So anytime he got to in a position in transition where they showed a wall, it was a dart. When he forced help, he was making the right reads, right passes. They just need to make sure they space the floor and allow him to make the right decisions. I thought they did a good job as far as using Drew as a screener to get Zach LaVine involved. So that, hey, we know you don't want to switch him on Giannis, so we can exploit that. I thought Brook Lopez had a few good cuts late in the game. So they found some things. The question is going to be the consistency. Now, to the Bucks defense and also the Bulls offense, which is why I wanted to pause you, because I want to give a salute to the Bulls. And the two most important pieces were Nikola Vucevic and Zach LaVine. Vucevic was aggressive, and Chicago needs that. They need him picking and popping. They need to be able to run sets for him to get him post-ups, get him movement. They need him to be more than just a connector, especially in this series. He's got to look at the rim. And I thought Zach LaVine, even though he had 20 on 13, was incredibly important with his aggression to see the drop, attack the drop, and finish. Then I'm going to mix in some passes to Vucevic. And then I'm going to mix in some pull-ups. And now what that does is puts pressure on Milwaukee. And those two are the key. Because if you're thinking about the Vucevic pop, and you're also worried about LaVine turning the corner or pulling up, that's going to force you to react. And that's going to open up plays for Chicago. And I think that's going to be the balance. If I'm Milwaukee, I need to figure out how to take out one, if not both of those guys. Because DeMar is DeMar. And DeMar put on a shot-making clinic in that one. Yes, he did. He put on a clinic. You want to drop? It doesn't matter. I'm taking one dribble and I'm letting this fly. Hey, Giannis, you want to start switching? Sweet. You can get this one dribble pull up too.
And he did a few times.
And that's where it gets interesting for Chicago, because one of the questions we asked coming into the series was, hey, can they even force the Bucks into help again? And now we get back to, oh, can they make them pay now that they're in rotation? And I think they did a decent job making at least the clutch buckets. Now, you saw Caruso with some misses, Williams with some misses. It happens. But if they're going to have those three pressure points, now it becomes a point where your shot making matters and has an impact, because there's no scheme for some of those shots that those guys make. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting. I don't understand what the Bucks are doing defensively. I know you got a Giannis rant in the tuck, and we're going to get to it. I'm sorry, Dunkers. I don't understand the point of being small and putting Giannis at the five and keeping him in the exact same deep drop that Brook Lopez was in. Make it make sense for me. Yeah, man, just make it make sense for me. Just make it make sense. You got three guys all playing the same coverage. What's the point?
It doesn't make sense. I'm not going to try to make that make sense. That was part of my frustration with Milwaukee in this game. Before I get into that, I do want to thank you for stopping me there, because I was very ready to just go into what the heck is going on with Milwaukee. They're doing this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, this wrong. I should have given a lot more credit to Chicago than I did, because they did play very good basketball on both ends. I was impressed with the way that they rotated on defense, their physicality on defense, the timeliness of the double teams offensively, the way that they just worked Milwaukee in pick and roll. Again, their spacing and where they placed their guys was much better than Milwaukee's. So, like, they won that game. And they deserve credit for that. DeMar DeRozan shot making, you just talked about what Zach LaVine and Nikola Vucevic were able to do. Alex Caruso, again, just a phenomenal game on both ends. He did miss some shots down the stretch, but he made a lot of timely ones in that game as well. So Chicago deserves their flowers. I didn't mean to gloss over that. To answer your question. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, to answer your question, though, I am not sure what was going on. And a lot of it starts with Giannis for me in that game. Like, the deep drop is one thing, which annoys me. Like, we've talked about this across multiple teams on this podcast already. But the deep drop is one thing. You can't be in a deep drop and then also give, like, soft contest at the rim. And outside of a stretch where Milwaukee was on a 14-2 run towards in the last, like, minute and a half of the third quarter, outside of that, like, I didn't feel Giannis either. It can't be both. You have to play higher up, be more aggressive. Not saying blitz, pick, and rolls, though, you know, midway through the fourth, Milwaukee did finally start showing at the level of the screen. They did start blitzing some. But it doesn't have to be that. Like, play a step or two closer, since y'all want to play these pick and pops, pretty much keep the two-on-two affair. Like, there needs to be tighter coverage there. But if you are going to go in a deep drop and say, all right, we're fine with giving up these jumpers above the break, if they beat us with jumpers, fine. When they get to the rim, play with some force. That was not a good defensive effort from Giannis. And I didn't really feel him as a helper sometimes. There were just a lot of contest rotations that weren't made from him that were just kind of weird. It wasn't a good defensive game for him. And this is a guy who has rightfully won a Defensive Player of the Year award before. He's in the running for it this year. We know what he can be. He gave us a stretch of what he is and can be during the game, but it just wasn't there consistently enough. So I just didn't like what they were doing from a scheme perspective.
Now, this is always an interesting point in these type of matchups, because there's a lot of things from Milwaukee to correct. And if they only do a few of them, they put themselves in a better position. For Chicago, while you have the template, you don't have a very large margin for error and you don't have very many paths for victory. So you need your three to get going and you need your defense to hold strong to have a shot. If any of those things go south, now you're kind of back in the same boat that you've been in. And that's kind of the interesting dynamic of this series. I think we got more of a fight than we may have expected. But you know, Chicago needs that effort from their big three again. They need to stay locked in defensively to give themselves a shot. If they can do that, the math gets interesting. If they can't, we don't talk about the series.
Yeah. And the math gets interesting by default because Chris Middleton suffered a sprained MCL in the game. And he is likely out for the rest of this series. And so now this shifts to who is Milwaukee playing and where do they go lineup-wise? Do they add Grayson Allen or Pat Connaughton to the starting lineup and go a little bit smaller? Which could make things a little bit easier in turn, make things a little bit interesting in terms of their rotations. Because, I mean, I think you're still going to have Wes Matthews taking the bar to Rosen. You're still going to have Drew Holiday on Zach LaVine. But now you have a little bit less size on the back end, or if Chicago wants to run some action, try to force a switch before getting into the, what they want to do, you have a smaller guy on one of those stars. So that could be a problem. Or do you size up? We've seen Milwaukee play Brooke, Bobby Portis, and Giannis at the same time. Do you do that and try to restrict space a little bit? What does that do to your shot creation on the other end? Like, that's going to be an interesting decision for Mike Budenholzer to make. And honestly, like, if they don't tighten up their process on both ends, like, I'm not sure how much that's going to matter, to be completely honest with you. Like, what they did in the half court for most of that game was, it ain't going to work from a process standpoint. Like, the fact that I have this many scheme things to be annoyed about before even getting into the actual player performances offensively. Like, Chris Middleton started cooking late before the injury, but he took some shots that I didn't know where they came from. I didn't like some of his process. And Drew Holiday, man, the decision-making just was not there at all. Like, there was a play early on where Milwaukee goes double drag and Chicago starts to, they switch the first two screens. And Drew throws a lob to Giannis that hits the backboard that Giannis, I don't even think, was looking for. And it's just like, yo, you are too good and have been in the lead too long for, like, predetermined reads like that. Like, he knew as soon as he was coming off the second screen, oh, I'm throwing this to Giannis. I see him switch. They switch the first screen. I know it's coming. And just didn't see that the role for Giannis wasn't clean. Chicago did a good job defending him. And you also had Zach LaVine drop it down into the paint because I think it was Wes Matthews in the corner. And it's just like, bro, look at – dribble with your head up. Like, bad process, bad result. It was just a mess. It was a mess. It was everything that I was frustrated about with this Milwaukee team during last postseason popping up.
If only.
If only.
If only, if only, if only. Well, I hope you feel better that you got that out of your system. Venting is important in life. Got to have a place to place your thoughts, and that's key. We might as well keep it out east. Do we want to just go into Nets Celtics?
Yeah, let's do it.
First off, this series is incredible. I don't think it's going to be appreciated like it should be because there's too many things to potentially slander. I get it. You guys have a blast. I'm not going to participate in that, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. Side note, Stan Van Gundy, please don't offend me on a national telecast like that ever again, saying this is the best Kevin Durant has ever been defended. The 2014 NBA playoffs exist. The Memphis Grizzlies did a great job. Again, we'll talk about that later.
Talk your talk.
No, I mean, they had the stat where it's like Kevin Durant in the series. Shout out to Kurt Goldsberry, by the way. 13 of 41 from the field, 12 turnovers, 8 assists. First time in his career he shot under 40 and committed 6-plus turnovers in consecutive games. That's tough. Salute to Boston. Now, games 3 and 4 in 2014, he was 15 of 48 from the field, 10 turnovers, 7 assists. It ain't that different, dog.
There we go.
Somebody threw those numbers at me at 5:45 this morning. I was ready. Anyways, what were your thoughts on this game? Because I feel like there's a few things to unpack. First off, were you impressed with Brooklyn's defense early?
I was impressed with the defense early, yes.
The hashtag is Big Agenda, folks. Kendrick Perkins on April 20th. Steve Nash finally doing something! Exclamation point. The adjustments by putting Bruce Brown on Tatum and letting KD guard Horford in that first quarter was huge. BTW, the best defensive quarter I've seen out of Brooklyn this season. Carry the hell on, dot, dot, dot.
Opening up a playoff series discussion with a big agenda. That's dirty. That is dirty. Wow.
Oops, I did it again.
Oh, God, we are not recording after 10:30 ever again. This is incredible. Anyway, yes, I was impressed with Brooklyn's defense. I was impressed with the physicality. Like, it was nice to see them because we knew they were going to switch. But it was nice to see them get into the jersey. Like, they took Jason Tatum out of it early. As a scorer, at the very least. Jason Tatum did still make solid passing reads. He was still reading the floor pretty well. But, like, they did not let him get comfortable as a scorer. They bumped them off ball. Again, the switches were aggressive when they did go to some of their off-ball screening stuff. And when he drove, there was help present. They were able to get out there and rotate. Like, Brooklyn was dialed in to start the game. You can continue.
Well, no, I thought the first half was a very interesting dynamic, and it's interesting to look back at it after we have the result, because Brooklyn's defense was active, really strong rotations. But how much did they want to be in rotation? How much did they have to be in rotation? And I thought the good thing that Boston did in that first half, as far as offensively goes, they stuck with what they do. And Tatum's the big thing we had with Boston during the season was it didn't feel like Tatum's scoring was creating opportunities for others. Not necessarily in the selfish take. That's a whole different take. But it just felt like teams were comfortable with how they were defending and they were going to live with the result. But Tatum was doing such a good job of getting in the paint, putting two on the ball, creating plays. It helped sustain. I mean, I think first half they had 18 field goals, 14 assists. That's positive process. So while they were down, they were doing the right things that could sustain. On the flip side, I thought Brooklyn, and I know this is firmly a very loud Steve Nash doesn't coach, Steve Nash doesn't make adjustments type of series, so I'm going to be in the minority here. I thought they set the tone early, offensively, as far as responding to what Boston had did in the first game, where Al Horford's on Bruce Brown, and he's a pest everywhere and help, causing chaos. And when he's in action, they said, cool. Hey, Bruce Brown, go sit in the corner. Drive kick, hit it. Let's send a message. Let's try and get to Al. You guys will be physical. KD backdoor. They did things as far as responses go. Now, the issue is over the course of the game, things get interesting. And I guess I'll pause there because there's some things Brooklyn needs to do. But I was more impressed with Boston's defense. How'd you feel about that?
I think Boston's defense ratcheted up. Like, it felt like Brooklyn kind of took them out of their flow early offensively. And then defensively, like you mentioned, the adjustment with Bruce Brown, it did feel like he was in a corner more. And seeing Sid, like, some more of the actions were in the middle of the floor and kind of forced those driving kicks. And it just took Boston a little bit to find their footing.
That's such an – I hate to interrupt. I'm all over the place, but let's have some fun tonight. That's such a dynamic piece of this series for Boston. They can hit pressure points in this series that maybe they don't always get to hit because of their size advantages, whether it's Tatum on the ball, whether it's using other guys, using Tatum as a screener. You can force mismatches or force two on the ball and now get to drive and kick in ways that maybe you normally don't. But continue on.
No, that's what I was going to say. Like, Brooklyn just – I think Brooklyn knocked them out of rhythm on both ends to a degree with their ratcheted up physicality on Jason Tatum, making him more of a passer. Like, shout out to, like, Grant Williams off top, who, as Brooklyn got out to the hot start, like, he kind of held them afloat with timely threes. Like, they were helping off of him. It's like, okay, we're going to muck things up. We're going to help off of you if you do try to get – if you do get penetration elsewhere. We're going to dare you to knock down shots. Grant Williams was able to do that. Peyton Pritchard was able to make that. Knock down timely shots. Daniel Tice knocked down timely shots. So they got enough from the others until, you know, we get to the fourth quarter where they really blew things up. Jason Tatum knocked down timely shots. Jaylen Brown just went off in the fourth quarter. They had no real answer for him. And I think just going to the size issue with Brooklyn, it really shone through in the fourth quarter where, like, Bruce Brown has had the Jason Tatum matchup pretty much all series long. And he did a solid job on Jason Tatum. Again, it was a team effort, but he's doing a solid job of bothering him. And now when Jaylen Brown gets loose, it's like, okay, what do we do with this exactly? Because if we put Bruce Brown on Jaylen Brown now, that's either forcing Kevin Durant into more of a defensive responsibility while he's already struggling with the physicality on the other end of the floor, and he has his workload to carry. And if it isn't KD and it isn't Bruce Brown, where are you going? It can't be Kyrie, who had some off-ball lapses, who honestly just didn't have that great of a floor game in game two. It's, I don't know, like this, I guess this kind of parlays into the Ben Simmons discussion since he may be back in game four. Like that would give Brooklyn a bigger body, another body, and also a body with size to help with one of those wings. And so you could at least go Bruce Brown on one, Ben Simmons on the other for however long he's going to be out there. Or are you about to jump in?
I was going to say, Ben Simmons, to me, the most intriguing part about him coming back would be the small lineup they could potentially throw out there. Not that it would save the day, but if you're telling me you can use Ben Simmons as a roller with some of the pieces they can have out there, I'm intrigued. For me with Brooklyn, it just feels like they've found pieces of what could work without having the stars sustain it, if that makes sense. So obviously you had the Kyrie game. You had good things in game two early. If you combine that with KD now making shots, we have a different story. And that's the toughest part of the series because, one, for Brooklyn, it just comes down to when does KD figure it out? Because I believe he's going to. This is a game plan that is effective, but it's a game plan that has an expiration date. Now, Boston could potentially win before the expiration date comes. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But he is the level of player that you're just kind of hanging on. I always liken it to, for any of you parents out here listening, it's kind of like pushing your toddler past nap time and you're out, maybe like a game, grocery store or something. You got your snacks. You got all the tricks you have, toys. But you know what's behind the other corner. You're just trying to hold on and hope you can limit the impact of the fury that's about to come your way. And for Boston to get these wins while he's struggling is huge. Now, the little things, I think, they try to get KD in the middle of the floor a little bit more. The issue is, again, Boston's base. And when I say base, I mean the help they show. Because usually if you go small or you try different things, you basically kind of trade some of your base tactics for the ability to stay out of rotation. Boston doesn't really do that. Watch Marcus Smart and watch how he helps off Kyrie early, gets back, recovers. Mm-hmm. Watch how Boston switches and just basically takes all the off-ball stuff off the menu. Like, cool, cool set. You want to call point chess? We're just going to switch everything. Now what? You're in the same situation. You've wasted 10 seconds. But with KD, it's about getting him in different spots, and it's about getting the right spacing. If you have shooters and you know Boston is helping off the wing to show help at the nail, put your best shooter there.
No, yeah.
Put your best shooter in the strong side corner. Move Al Horford all the way over, all the way out of there. Make KD at the elbow. Al Horford's got to chill on the other side. If Daniel Tice is on the floor, he needs to be involved in every single pick and roll or every single action. There's no reason not to. He's your pressure point. Open things up that way. You've got to find the creases when you can to help elevate what you're doing. And too often, it felt like they may have had the right idea or the right mindset or tried to counter, but you look up and now your spacing's off, the help is still there and all that good stuff. And I thought Boston did a heck of a job as far as switching, especially as the game wore on, taking things off the menu. And it got to the point where, okay, where's Brooklyn trying to attack? And so they just got to mix more of that in. And if you're going to execute this way, try and bend Boston. Try and make them make decisions and try and capitalize off of it.
To that point, well, one, you're absolutely right. Like, there are ways for, I guess, Nash and the crew to kind of scheme things up, have the shooters in different areas, make it life easier on the stars. And on the other end of the spectrum, like, the stars have to make plays. Like, KD has to make shots, of course. But with as physical as Boston is being, and with the way that they're showing help, like KD can't force the issue the way he has with some of these attacks. Like he's dribbling in to help. I tweeted about this, and this is something you've talked about with how, you know, teams are. I think the first time you talked about this with me was in reference to Luka Doncic. And I think you had a thread on it on your timeline about teams kind of showing help and digging from the strong side corner when he's trying to drive. And like Boston is doing a similar thing. They'll run a set for KD, or KD will just walk it up and he'll try to drive to his left if he's on the left wing or whatever. And you have Marcus Smart. Like there was a possession in the fourth quarter, I want to say, where Kevin Durant was on the left wing. He drives Kyrie Irving's in the left corner and Marcus Smart is there. Marcus Smart is showing help anyway. And it's just like, okay, so make the pass. Kyrie can either make the shot or drive and attack and, you know, try to attack Marcus Smart off the bounce or go from there. But like, you are not helping yourself. Like a lot of the turnovers that Kevin Durant's had in this series so far has been with him driving into an already crowded area. And that's a testament to Boston showing their help, showing they're doing their homework early, but also like read the floor too. Because there were plenty of passes to be made in the fourth quarter of game two from KD and from Kyrie. And like that's on them. Like it's easy to talk about Steve Nash sometimes, and you know, there's low hanging fruit for him to grab again with the spacing where you're putting your guys. But also, like, if you know where guys are helping, if you know the areas that they want to take you away from, have your counters intact. Move the ball, make your move elsewhere. It seems it just felt like in the case of Kevin Durant in particular, it feels a lot like he's trying to force his way through the block. He knows what Boston wants to take away from him. He's trying to force his way out of that versus, okay, this is what you're giving me. I'm just going to take this then. And there just has to be better decision-making on his end.
No, yeah, it's going to be fun to continue to watch and see if Brooklyn can figure this out, because there becomes a scenario if the nail help that Boston's selling out on becomes a kick and they're hitting those shots. How do you react? Can you get Al in a position where you're hurting him? Can you explore to where Tice is coming off the floor earlier, or you're exploiting and scoring against him? So now Boston has to lean on that smaller lineup more and you get more tape on it, more attacks. And what's it look like when KD shoots the ball well? You know, how do you supplement that? Because that's tough. It's a fun series. Boston put up a heck of an effort. Brooklyn had two shots at it. And that's the tough part about the playoffs. You have your opportunities. You get the Kyrie game. You get the Goran Bruce Brown game.
Yeah. Goran's been good in the series.
And you win one of those, and the conversation is different, but you're down 0-2. So now you got to go back to Brooklyn with a notorious home court advantage and try and pull one up.
Best of luck to the Brooklyn Nets. They're going to have the work cut out for them. And like Boston has to be feeling pretty good right now. If they're able to snag one in Brooklyn, that's a tough spot to be in, even with Ben coming back. What's your confidence level in Brooklyn right now? Do you think they can turn this around at home?
Well, I mean, I picked them in six.
Ah, I see.
I think they can. I think they can, because I think being competitive with your stars playing at that level shows, hey, there's something here. You just don't want to be in a position where you're having to rely on your defense to that level. And that's where the shot making is going to have to show up at some point. And you have to hope that happens. Maybe you loosen Boston's defense up. You're able to continue the activity, maybe stymie Tatum some more, maybe figure out some things with the size mismatch, throw some doubles if you need to, and just try and throw Boston out of rhythm that way and hope you could score on the other end. But it's going to come down to KD and Kyrie making plays and putting pressure on Boston in a different way. Because it feels like if, you know, we talk about three different phases of defense, Boston's done a lot of dictating, a lot of anticipating, not a lot of reacting. If you're Brooklyn, you want to get Boston in that reacting phase more.
We got to move in. I think that's why it's important to note, like, there was more Steph Curry involvement in game two versus game one. Like, he's part of the puzzle in terms of, like, where to space the guys. You talked about putting your best shooter on the wing. Like, get him there. He had some ISO possessions where he kind of bailed him out a few times. Like, use him as a threat, because Boston is sure looking for him on the other end. So, like, if you have to deal with that, like, you might as well make sure you're getting 16, 17, 18 points from Steph Curry. Like, make him part of the reason you're able to scramble Boston's defense a little bit. Actually, quick Nets question for you before we move to, I guess, the last Eastern Conference series since we've gone through all of them. Where are you at on Andre Drummond in the series?
They need his roles. They need his size. They need his rebounding. He has to play and be effective. They have to match his minutes up with Tice, probably. But they're running out of tall people. So they got to find something for him. Claxton hasn't been able to have the impact because of that Tatum matchup. And then where else do you go?
Okay. To that point, like, I'm feeling weird about him defensively. Because I agree with you. You do need the rolls from him. You need the rebounding from him. You need the size from him in general. And defensively, it looks like they have adjusted a bit because he was in a drop in game one. It felt like he was a bit of a pressure point. In game two, they were showing him to the level, which makes sense with his skill set. But he was showing at the level with just about every screen he faced. And so you got into some Marcus Smart, Daniel Tice pick and rolls that he's showing high against. This is like, wait a minute. I don't know if that's what you want to do. So I do feel like there's a little bit of a balance that needs to be struck with him. I don't know. Like, they need him because as much as Nick Claxton is going to be needed in this series with his switching, I don't know if this can be a 32-minute per game Nick Claxton series. Because if you get to the point where he's just flat out overtaking Drummond, then I think that's saying a lot about where Brooklyn is with their front court.
No, I feel it. Makes sense. The other thing is, if he ends up on Horford, now Horford spaces and Drummond's doing help things, and that's not what you want. Side note, shout out to Al Horford. He's on absolute demon time. He's having a playoff series that every team that he's ever been on has wished and wanted and needed from him. He's doing it right now, both ends of the floor. Not being passive when he has the shot. Defensively, he's been all over the place. So salute to him.
Good for Al Horford, man. I'm glad he's having the series that he's having. I'm glad he's having the year that he's having. Like, I've been waiting for the moment where it's like, I'm just waiting for him to have the slippage on defense. Because he's had to do so much. He's had to switch so much this year. He's had to defend so many isolations. And we get to the postseason, and he's playing better than he was during the regular season on defense. Like, he's matched up with KD and looked fine. He's switched out onto Kyrie Irving and held his own in space. Or, like, all right, cool. I'm just going to trap. Good luck. I'm a large man with active hands. Like, do something about it.
I will say, if it slips, this series changes.
Yeah, that could get a little bit tough because they're already having to cover a little bit for Daniel Tice. And so you can't have both of those guys on the court at the same time, and they both become pressure points. Because if you get to the point where both of those guys are in a drop, like, that's going to be the avenue for Kevin Durant to get rolling or for Kyrie Irving to have another outing like he did in game one. All right, let's get into Hawks Heat. The Heat have a 2-0 series lead after a 115-105 victory. In game two, Jimmy Butler lost his mind. Absolutely lost his mind. Playoff career high, 45 points for him. Go ahead.
The hashtag is big apology, folks.
There was a lot of bucket getting done in that game. I will give it to him. I was not expecting 407 from three. I was not expecting pull up threes in transition. The drives, the playmaking, yeah. And he did a good job of finding matchups.
I knew it was something different when this man took a 1-2 footwork, perfect form 3-point shot. He's in a different place. But I'm going to let you ice on this because I feel like this is your series. This is your bag.
Yeah. We'll be in Atlanta on Sunday. But First and foremost, I was impressed with what Atlanta was able to do defensively in this game, which sounds wild considering Jimmy Butler absolutely torched them. But the energy level, the effort level was just overall better. You got John Collins at the five to start in this one, and you had John Collins in a drop, which typically isn't a good thing. Like, if John Collins' best use is like a weak side roamer at the four or in a switch all scheme because he has the mobility to do so. So him in a drop in a vacuum is like, okay, I don't know if I love this at all. But he was pretty solid in the drop, and I was impressed with the help that was shown. Whenever Miami tried to run pick and rolls on us from the wing, Atlanta iced just about every last one of them, forced them all down the sideline. And so you had Kevin Huerter doing well at the point of attack. Trae Young was a lot feistier defensively overall. I was very impressed with how much effort he shown there, fighting over screens, staying connected to guys. He was showing early help. He was making rotations. Like, this is the Trae Young that we saw last postseason. Not an elite defender by any stretch, but he was very firmly a do-your-job guy, and he did that in game two. Atlanta's going to need that moving forward in the series. But to that point, like, they did ice a lot of pick and rolls. Collins was solid. Huerter did a good job. Bogdanovich did a good job. DeLon Wright did a very good job defensively in that game. And the help was there on time. You'd have Bam Adebayo rolling towards the middle of the floor. You'd have Dwayne Dedmon rolling towards the middle of the floor. And the help was early. They were able to tag that role, get back out the shooters, and they made Miami work a little bit. And that was very much apparent in the first half of that game, where it felt like Miami's offense was in the mud a bit. They could not generate the advantages that they were able to in game one. Because a lot of that was designed to attack Trae Young. Like, all right, we're going to start with these cross screens. We're going to start with these flat screens. We're going to try to get Trae in action. Let's see if we can force an unfavorable switch. Let's see how lazy he is. And when that wasn't there, there was a little bit of, oh, okay, let's get into something else then. And Miami was able to do that. They were able to find a flow, particularly in the second half. But at first half, Atlanta, to your point, like, felt like they did a little bit more dictating on the defensive end. So I was impressed by that. But on the Miami side of the equation, it starts with Jimmy Butler, the shot making from him. And another quiet game for Bam Adebayo, at least offensively, because of the foul trouble. But because he was in foul trouble, we got to see more Caleb Martin in game two. And that man was all over the place. He got the Trae Young matchup. He was also flying off the ball. Offensively, timely cuts, made passes to keep the offense moving, made timely threes from the corner. He did everything Miami needed him to do. That was a fun effort from him. I was intrigued by Bam getting in foul trouble and Miami immediately going to PJ Tucker at the five and Caleb Martin at the four. That was not a lineup tweet that I thought that we would see, especially now. like, I was very firm. I just knew, okay, Bam's in foul trouble. Here comes Dwayne Dedmon. Let's see if he gets an extended run here. And he played, but it was a lot of PJ at the five. And Miami was able to maintain their defensive base because of that. It was still a lot of switching. Like, Trae Young didn't have a good time. He wasn't able to kind of dictate things like you thought he would be able to. It was a lot of game one. We're going to throw different guys at him at the point of attack. If he tries to hunt for Tyler Hero or Max Strus or someone else, we are going to trap, or we're just going to show help aggressively and force a kick out. And they were still able to do that. Trae was able to get going some, knock down some tough shots at the back end of the clock. But again, it was on Miami's terms. It wasn't on Atlanta's. And so it was, I guess it was interesting to me to see Atlanta play better, also make adjustments, and you still get this from Miami. Like, you got Miami in the mud like you wanted to. You made them think a little bit more defensively because, I mean, they were still throwing these traps at Trae, but you had John Collins slipping into space. And the spacing was pretty smart on the Atlanta side, so they were able to generate some threes there. And then Miami's counterpunch was like, all right, cool. Jimmy Butler, you're just going to be the best player on the court again. And so now it's 2-0 heading to Atlanta. They have some good things to look at, but they're also in a hole right now. I think that's my spiel on this.
No, I like it. Preach. Preach the gospel. Have the Hawks done enough offensively for you to think they can execute the template? Because I think for them, it just, again, has to be, we score enough points, we battle defensively, we get Miami in the mud, and we see what happens. But have they done enough as far as movement goes? Because it's ironic. Miami's been flying around this series. Their defense has been on a different level. Atlanta was able to find some creases. You still have to face that. over and over and over again. And that makes it tough. So do you have enough belief in their offense right now?
Not really. Because there were more cracks than there were in game one, but it still wasn't enough to feel good about Atlanta just like blitzing them. And I go back to the second quarter where, again, Atlanta was playing well and they had a lead headed to halftime. But like there was like a three possession stretch where Miami defended incredibly and Atlanta's working incredibly hard to get good looks. And Miami would get a deflection and Atlanta would get the loose ball and they get an open shot out of it. Like there was one where Bam reached, can't remember who the guy was that was driving. I think it was Bogdan Bogdanovic. And he was driving from the right wing. And Bam Adebayo helps from the nail, strips him, lose the ball. Kyle Lowry dives for it, doesn't get it. DeLon Wright picks it up, gets a wide open three out of it. And it's just like, it's cool that Atlanta's winning those, but the fact that they have to work this hard and that's the way the shot was created, it kind of speaks to the work they have to put in. And like, it just doesn't feel, none of it feels easy. And I think the work that Miami has done on Trae Young in these first two games, like that's kind of been the series. Because in game one, they were defending Trae well. Their offense was dead in the water for a little bit. And then they started knocking out every three imaginable and the game got blown open. In game two, Miami defended Trae well. And you were getting Bogdanovic knocking down shots. You were getting DeAndre Hunter making tough shots. And then Jimmy Butler took over. And it just didn't feel like Trae could get in the flow at all. Kyle Lowry had an initial matchup for him. He had Kyle Lowry. He had Jimmy Butler. He had Caleb Martin. He got some PJ Tucker on him. And they're just switching all over the place, and they're sending traps, and they're helping from the strong side sometimes to thwart them. And you look at Trae's box score, it's 25, 6, and 7. But watch the game, and you'd be surprised that he had that. Miami's been putting him through the ringer through two games.
Yep. I mean, for Miami, you guys keep taking care of business, stay locked in defensively, and try and avoid the turnover foul trap. I think you'll be happy with what you get.
There you go. Oh, one more guy that got the Trae Young assignment, Gabe Vincent, who was wild in game two. He is very fun to watch at the point of attack.
I like it. So right. we wrapped up the East?
Yeah, we have wrapped up the East. Let's get to the Western Conference. Let's get to Pelicans Suns.
Let's talk about these Chris Paul's unders.
Oh, here we go.
Let's talk about it, King.
Is this what we're on? All right. The Pelicans were able to win game two, 125-114. A huge Brandon Ingram game, 37-11-9 for him. Timely shot making from CJ McCollum. You had a 31-point first half from Devin Booker, and he got hurt in the third quarter. He has suffered an hamstring injury. His status for the rest of the series is very much up in the air. Since you have Chris Paul slander to get off, I suppose I can concede the floor to you. What did you see in this game two from New Orleans?
I don't have Chris Paul slander to get off. Just some questions for you. I thought New – well, first off, salute to Devin Booker. He was having a heck of a game. Unfortunately, that he got hurt. I thought New Orleans found some things, you know. And I just go to in watching that game, watching the first two games, one of the big pieces for Phoenix has been Jay Crowder and Mikal Bridges' defense against CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram. And what's that done? What that has done is really affected New Orleans' ability to run those actions with their top three guys. Because in theory, those two, Ingram and CJ, have the bucket-getting potential to test DeAndre Ayton in a different way. And we hadn't been able to see it because the Suns basically just said, hey, any pick and roll you guys run on the side, we're going to keep it on the side. Mm-hmm. DeAndre, you chill. We'll navigate the screen. You bounce back. Now you guys don't have much. Now Jonas is just popped standing there. And we're looking like, okay, what do we do next? But I thought as the game went on, they found things. I thought putting Larry Nance Jr. at the five and saying, hey, second unit, JaVale McGee, all switches. What are y'all going to do now? Y'all not going to have the same openings. You're not going to have the same anything like that. I think they also continued to grind offensively and really found some good actions. And as the game went on, you saw those screens that were on the side with CJ and Ingram start to be more in the middle. And so there was more pressure that was put on Phoenix. There was more, hey, Chris Paul, you come defend this action. Let's put you in action, all due respect. And so I think that combined with their defense was just really good. And their ability to force help and move the ball was something you didn't really expect, you know? And I think putting them in those kind of positions helps. I really thought the Pelicans did a good job. Where were you at with it?
I'm mostly with you. Like, I think the process got a lot better. Like, we saw towards the end of game one where New Orleans, at least with Larry Nance at the five, where New Orleans went from, okay, we're going to drop him to, okay, we're going to show him a little bit higher to, okay, we're just going to switch this. Let's see if we can flatten him out. And by that fourth quarter, as I was just like losing my mind watching this game, because Chris Paul's just knocking down jumpers and getting to the rim a couple of times, it was nice. But that did kind of flatten out what Phoenix wanted to do. Like, it went from Chris Paul is carving this team up to Chris Paul is beating switches, which is cool, but it did take a little bit longer for him to do that. And so now you fast forward to this game and you get Larry Nance Jr. in, and now off rip, it's like, all right, we're just going to switch this. Let's see who has off the dribble bounce on this team. And Phoenix struggled a bit. Like, you won't see that in terms of like the numbers, the offensive rate, especially late in the game, was high. But just from a process standpoint, the looks weren't as easy as they were. And so it just turned into, okay, what can we run that at least temporarily gets them into a drop? And Phoenix was able to find stuff in that fourth quarter. I ended up writing an article for basketballnews.com talking about some of the lifts that they had in the half court. That they would run a high pick and roll. They would run a go screen and then flow into a pick and roll, and they have a guy lift from the corner to the wing just to kind of stress them that way. And they were able to find some good stuff out of that. The problem is that New Orleans was cooking on the other end. So even though Phoenix was scoring at a high clip, New Orleans was scoring at a higher clip, and they already had the lead. So I'm curious to see, like, if Phoenix is able to generate similar things without Devin Booker consistently, because that becomes the key to me for Phoenix. They don't have, like, their best switch beater from the perimeter is gone now. And I don't think DeAndre Ayton is going to be seeing switches unless he's matched up with Larry Nance Jr. And so now the onus is going to shift to Chris Paul. Like, okay, can you replicate the fourth quarter of game one over and over and over and over and over again? And then when you're not on the court, who's doing it? Cam Johnson showed growth this year off the bounce. You're going to be in some of Devin Booker's sets. Like, can you get busy? Mikal Bridges, same thing. What are you going to do? Campaign, who's had a pretty quiet two games so far. Like, will that juice from earlier in the season return? And they're going to need somebody that's going to be able to crack this New Orleans defense at this point.
I'm interested to see what the menu is going to be for Phoenix offensively, because Devin Booker has a lot of movement sets. You can disguise him in a lot of different ways, and that opens a lot of things up. And then I'm also interested to see the mindset of Chris Paul as he enters into this one. We've seen him time and time again in the postseason kind of data collect for the first three quarters. I don't know if they can afford that. This has to be one of those first quarter, I'm taking four or five straight pull-ups types games. It feels like that to me. And the interesting part there is going to be, what does that do to Jonas Valanciunas and his pick-and-roll coverage? Because Phoenix and DeAndre Ayton, I don't think he gets enough credit for his ability to screen for Chris Paul. To know, hey, if you're going to try and keep it on the side, I'm going to quickly flip it, and now it's a step up, he's getting downhill. Or Jonas is at the level, I'm bouncing right to the pocket, and we're good. Can Chris Paul do enough to get JV to the level? Because if JV comes to the level, it's going to open everything up. That's the danger of being aggressive and active against Chris Paul. He's going to hit the roller. Now they're playing out of it. Now you're in rotation. So how does Phoenix handle that? And can New Orleans stick with their what they found in that last game? Because while it was a lot of shot making, they did put some pressure on Phoenix late in that game when they were executing, getting more movement, getting in pick and roll, allowing themselves to get Phoenix in rotation. And does CJ's shot making bring DeAndre Ayton to the level? Is that a test we haven't seen? Mm-hmm. Does Ingram's shot making bring DeAndre Ayton to the level? Does that open things up for New Orleans? So it's a very interesting blend as far as what the response is going to be from Phoenix, especially considering all these unders that Chris Paul has seen.
Gonna sneak that one in there, huh? I see.
What? I didn't hear anything.
Yeah, I bet. But no, to the Ayton point, like, it's only been two games, so the sample size is only so large. But it is interesting to me that we haven't really seen him switch at all. Like, it wasn't super necessary in game one. And in game two, again, Brandon Ingram started cooking. CJ McCollum, though, there was at least one midway through the fourth quarter where he gets a high pick and roll, just kind of walks into a pull-up three. Like, it is curious that it's weird that he hasn't played higher or just flat out switched those, because he can switch. And so I wonder if we're going to get to a point in game three or moving forward where Phoenix is like, okay, we're just going to take away these openings no matter what. Like, Ayton can move in space. We trust Jay Crowder as a helper. We trust Mikal Bridges as a helper. Let's just restrict space. Let's just make sure they don't have openings. Let's get this in the mud. And if we're going to turn this into like a half-court execution fest, let's take our chances here. Because at the end of the day, like, Phoenix can switch DeAndre Ayton. I don't think New Orleans can switch JB if it boils down to it. And so we'll see if we get to a situation where that kind of gets pushed a little bit. And if Phoenix figures like, okay, they're not going to switch JB, we're either going to get a drop, or like we saw in the fourth quarter game too, we're going to see him showing him at the level where he's blitzing Chris Paul. Like, we're going to have some openings. And so that seems to be the pressure point. So I guess I'm just going to be watching what JB's going to look like the rest of the series.
That's going to be an interesting one. The game three is going to be very interesting. Phoenix needs to be ready for New Orleans, because if New Orleans can continue to play with confidence, continue to find something, feel like they're there, that's a lot to deal with. You get CJ going, you get Ingram going, you get them flowing together, it's a lot.
This is the shot.
Yeah, game three is their moment. That's one of those you got to capitalize on. Speaking of capitalizing, what's up with Utah?
Oh, boy. I don't know where to start with Utah. I'm going to be completely honest with you. We are recording, I guess, technically now on a Friday morning after some technical difficulties. I have not seen
the game. Technical difficulties. This man is on the 59th floor of a hotel and couldn't even get the Wi-Fi. Oh, always get the Wi-Fi package. Ask for the Ethernet cord. Pro moves. Come on.
Wow. Okay. Anyway, I have not seen game three, but it looks like Dallas has won game three. And so since I have not seen that game, I guess I want to ask you about your takeaways from game two.
Oh, my takeaways from game two? I gave my takeaways from game two and a half as well.
Oh, all right.
Utah's in trouble. I mean, if you look at what happened, and I'll just briefly speak on the piece of the game three that I saw. Dallas isn't even running plays when it counts. It's hunting Donovan Mitchell, but also any of these guards. Hey, you come here, let's put our head down and see what happens. Side note, Maxi Kleber, 4 for 5 from three in game three.
This is after knocking down 8 threes in game two, huh?
Yep. Josh Green, 3 for 5 from three. Good for him.
Oh, he did the thing. I can't wait to watch this then.
Davis, a.k.a. Dave Burt, 4 for 7 from three. And for Utah, it's the same issues that we've talked about. Donovan Mitchell scores 32. Mike Conley scores 21. Bogey scores 24. 39 field goals, 20 assists. You're making shots. You're not creating shots. You're not creating opportunities. You're not changing anything. And I thought it got to the point for Utah where they were mismatch hunting, having Conley screen for Donovan Mitchell. Just imagine and think about the Utah Jazz going from the pick and roll offense we saw last year to mismatch hunting, kind of a wild swing. Mm-hmm. But Dallas did an incredible job of saying, that's fine. We'll give you the switch. We're also going to double. And that caused chaos. Because now Rudy's just standing down there on the block. Everyone's in front. The rotation is there. Dallas' defense has been incredible, by the way. I don't think it gets enough credit for what they've done. But it's not fun times for the Utah Jazz right now. And it's like a multiple layered issue. Where are your thoughts? Because I have more, but I'll let you cook.
Well, I'll jump in. I'll be brief because I want to hear your thoughts on this series. I just find myself, I am impressed by Dallas and them just kind of finding answers offensively. Like the series that Jalen Brunson is having right now is incredible. And Spencer Dinwiddie, after a pretty shaky game one, certainly stepped up in game two, particularly late in game two. And at the very least, the box score looks pretty solid for him in game three. Again, I haven't watched that one yet. But I just find myself disappointed by Utah defensively. Like, it's a problem from the top down. Like, I almost lost my podcast host at the beginning of the series where I said I'm a little – I'm just keeping an eye on Mike Conley defensively. But Donovan Mitchell has just been flat out bad. He just hasn't been able to shake it. You have Royce O'Neal fighting for his life against guards. You have Bojan Bogdanović fighting for his life on the ball and being tasked with making a bunch of help rotations defensively when the guards get beat off the dribble. And he's having himself a time trying to rotate and help. And then there's Rudy Gobert, who once Dallas wants to space you out, he finds himself in the corner. And he has to make a decision. Like, okay, am I helping from this corner at the rim or am I staying home and watching my guards get beat to the basket every time now? Rudy helps, it's a kick out. Rudy doesn't, it's a bucket or a foul. And so I ended up writing about the end of game two in particular. Like, there was one where Rudy helped down from the corner and it wasn't his help responsibility at all. I'm just like, well, in this instance, I understand why you help because your guards get beat by like a drum, but help would have had to come from the weak side corner, not from you. So you are giving up a three to Maxi Kleber, who's already hit five or six at that point. Like, you probably shouldn't help, especially when it's not your responsibility. So, like, everyone is just kind of in flux right now. Guards
everyone,
can't.
Everyone.
Guards can't keep guys in front. Rudy's in a pick your poison situation. Bojan isn't nailing the help stuff at all. And then on offense, Dallas is like, all right, cool. We're going to switch or we're going to switch and trap. Which the latter, you would think, would put Utah in a position of forcing the rotation like they want to. Like, they want to get you moving. But Dallas is, like, dictating that. Like, no, we're forcing the ball out of this guy's hand. We're going to force these other guys to make decisions. And they're not making good decisions. The ball is sticking or we're getting erratic shots. And it's just like, what has the regular season been for? Exactly. If you don't have answers for this.
The biggest thing for me with Rudy is just having the nuance when he's spaced. I understand why he helps. I understand that Utah gives up a lot of dribble penetration, but you got to know when you need to go. And you got to be able to play that cat and mouse game when you're on the weak side. And it feels like it's kind of the same movie over and over again. And Dallas is even doing the tricky part of, hey, Rudy, not only are we going to try and force you to help, we're going to put you in different spots. So your man might be on the wing, might be in the strong side corner, might be in the weak side corner, but you got to figure this out because we're driving by everyone. I mean, we've gotten to the point of the series where Dallas is like, hey, Luka, just chill. Don't worry about it. Take another night off.
What a wild sentence. Like, Dallas has played three games without Luka Doncic, and they are up in the series right now. Lost home court and got it back in game three without Luka. And Utah just looks, man. Man, I want to give, like, super deep, detailed analysis and all this good stuff, but, like, I'm just sad, man. A team that's had the kind of movement they've had offensively in the Quinn Snyder era meets some switches, and it's just like, oh, well, all that's done. We don't know what to do with this. Like, what is this? You get a switch and trap, like a team is literally giving you a 4-on-3. You just had the best offensive rating in basketball. You're being given 4-on-3s and you can't make lemonade. Like, what is happening to this offense? It's wild to me.
Dallas actually gave Rudy Gobert the role, and that told me everything about how they felt about the Utah Jazz right now. It's crazy. Utah has to bounce back. They've got to get their tempo up. They've got to keep the ball in front. If a Dallas Mavericks team without Luka Doncic can comfortably just not run plays, you've got an issue.
It's so, man. And they're missing their best guy. Luka Doncic is a top five driver in basketball, and Dallas is still winning with the put your head down offense. I'm disappointed.
The hashtag is big apology. Spencer Dinwiddie with another big game. Jalen Brunson just backing the truck up right now.
Yeah. Shout out, was that World Wide West at game 2 to check out Jalen Brunson, I guess? Is that allowed? Like, how are we?
I'm not touching this one.
All right, let's get. Oh, goodness, we'll close it out. What are the Warriors Nuggets takeaways we have right now?
What are your Warriors Nuggets takeaways, sir?
Game 3 is going on right now. It's a nail biter in Denver, thank goodness, because the first two games will kind of follow the same script. It's like, oh, this is cool, this is close. Golden State's like, all right, cool, we're just going to bury a bunch of threes, we're going to get running, your defense doesn't have a great answer against us, we're going to pull away. We got a tight one in Denver right now. Can't wait to dig into that one. Overall takeaway is this does not seem to be a good series for anyone defensively for Denver. Like, just from a comfort level. Like, we've talked about the Jokic thing already. Like, do you play him at the level and open up short roll, or do you play him in a drop and allow the movement shooters to get free? But Monte Morris at the point of attack is okay. He's not great, and he's tasked with fighting over and trying to stay attached to a Steph or a Jordan Poole whenever he's matched up with him. Aaron Gordon is a very, 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 very good wing defender. To navigate the kind of off-ball screens that he has to navigate and also have to try to navigate help on top of that, like, this isn't the ideal series for his skill set. And then you look beyond Jokic. If you're playing Jeff Green at the five, that's – you can switch him. This isn't the Jeff Green we saw even last year defensively. Might be a problem. Jermichael Green, he's not going to put out water as a switch defender against this Warriors team. DeMarcus Cousins, you're not switching him. You can play him high, but who's making the rotations behind him? Like, that's a bit of a problem. And so I say this with, like, the first two games in mind, because I have not watched the third game yet, which is now tied up with 4:14 left in the fourth quarter. So that's fun. But just based on the first two, like, I don't feel good about anyone defensively in this series for Denver. And this is with Steph working his way back and making an early six man of the year case, apparently, because he's been insane. Jordan Poole has been lights out.
And early what?
It's a joke. You know, he's going to get back in the starting lineup soon. It's fine.
My bad. I missed the play.
It's all right. But that's just kind of my thing. Like, the Warriors seem to have all the answers here. And they're able to dictate things on both ends in a way that I don't know if the Nuggets have answers for outside of playing above their heads, which, if that's what you got to rely on, that doesn't seem great.
I mean, the Nuggets are fighting. That's the one thing that they are going to do the rest of the way. And, you know, you see them make adjustments in a game 3, putting Aaron Gordon more on Steph Curry, Jokic getting to the level. I think Kevon Looney's only played 9 minutes in this game due to foul trouble. So Denver's going to try and scrap their way through this. But again, the question becomes, do they have enough? Now, the positive if they're able to pull out this game three, is you got a lot of footage against that smaller lineup. And if Jokic can kind of figure some things out against Draymond, that helps you. Because that's Golden State's big joker in this series. This is our lineup. See what I did there?
That's a good shot.
This is what we have. This is what you can't beat. So even if you scrap, we still have this. Now, if Denver can make some headway, that makes things a little bit more interesting. Now, if they can defend Jordan Poole, maybe get one of those games where he's 8 for 22. Maybe it gets a little interesting. If you can make it where you don't have an answer for Jokic, we could have some fun. But Denver's not going to go away without a fight. I do know that much. Golden State's going to have to earn this.
They're going to have to earn this. Just as a quick box score check, in 35 minutes of play, Nikola Jokic has 37 points, 16 rebounds, 5 assists, and 3 steals. There's a plus 10 on the evening. So things seem to be going pretty well. And as you said, like he's probably seen quite a bit of that small lineup against Golden State in light of Kevon Looney's foul trouble. And so if Dre's not having a fun time, that's going to get tight for everyone. I feel like Kevon Looney's done a good job through the first two games of the series against him. But there is still a size mismatch there.
There is. Well, one adjustment I like that Denver did is just going to a pick and pop with Jokic. Only because, hey, in theory, you're probably going to go under whoever's handling the ball. But if Jokic can knock down those shots or drive and finish, there's no one behind Draymond. Mm-hmm. So again, if they can move Jokic around, that can open some things up. If you can hurt that small lineup defensively, then you put yourself in a position where, hey, y'all really got to earn this. And it's going to take those guards off the bench making shots. It's going to take Jokic carrying the way. They don't have a lot of margin for victory, but they're going to fight.
That's all they can do. Could I ask you a quick, free throw-y question? I think I've asked you before, but I just want to check in on it.
What you got?
Jordan Poole is Golden State's blank best player.
Best are important.
Yes.
Still fourth.
Okay. Just wanted to check in. How have you felt about the Andrew Wiggins minutes so far in the series?
He's just very Andrew Wiggins for me. Not moved either way. Doing his job.
I mean, that's all they need him for, offensively at the very least. A lot of cuts, a lot of threes. Didn't have to handle too much. Like, I do think with those three guys in tow now, Steph, Clay, and Jordan Poole, they're handling so much of the on-ball stuff. Like, Andrew Wiggins is now slotted back into the role that made him an all-star this season. That's going to take some getting used to, but that's fine. But put him in a play-finisher role, like, he can do some good things for you. And so at least through the first two games, again, I haven't watched the third one yet, but through the first two games, like, it's felt pretty natural for him. In light of Denver trying to find an answer for those guards and pick and roll, like, it seems like he's had a lot of catch and shoot opportunities or just being able to cut behind guys. And so as long as he keeps that up, like, he's going to continue to see a lot of success.
Lost in Jordan Poole series is Klay Thompson has returned. He has enjoyed his time in the playoffs. What, 19 in game one, 21 in game two. He's hit 6 threes in game three. That's a key piece right there.
Might be a problem, yeah. If we can look ahead a bit, I don't know how fair that is. But.
Wow.
I just wanted to pose the question. Because we talked about this before the playoffs started. We talked about like a Golden State Memphis series or just that bracket. I know I got to a point before the season ended where I was like, you know, if Golden State faces Memphis, like I would probably pick Memphis right now.
You trying to not get packed up. I see you.
No, but I mean, this is the take that I had on the podcast. I was like, Memphis is looking really good. Like Golden State's going to have to get healthier, but even when they do get healthier, like the last year and a half of matchups between these two, like Memphis seems to have some answers. They have a level of athleticism that Golden State hasn't had much fun trying to deal with. But now I'm looking at how these teams have played in the postseason so far. As you mentioned, Klay seems to be right back in form now, at least offensively. Jordan Poole is taking a step up. Steph looks pretty darn good. Draymond is back. Like, Golden State feels Western Conference Finals team to me, at a minimum. And like, in light of the Devin Booker injury, like, this could be the path for them to get back.
Boy, a couple injuries, and you off the Bucks, Suns bandwagon that fast?
I'm saying, like, this.
Are we getting the Warriors Celtics tweets? What's happening?
No Warriors Celtics tweets for me right now. Like, I want to see the Chris Middleton recovery time, and I also want to see the Devin Booker recovery time, because if they're able to get back, like, full disclosure, I would still pick both of those teams to win their first round series. I think it's going to be tougher for them. Again, Milwaukee's going to have to find it from a shot making perspective, and just trying to figure out like how they want to deal with the size issue that they may have. And for Phoenix, Devin Booker is a big shot creative piece. Like, he's their best scorer. And so they're going to have to find a way to create advantages without him. But I think they'll be able to navigate that in the first round. Second round, I think that's really when those teams are going to need those guys back. Because if you're looking at, I picked Boston in six. If Boston's able to win that series, if we get Bucks, Celtics without Chris Middleton, that's kind of tough. Not even kind of tough. That's just incredibly tough. That was going to be a great series regardless. If you remove Chris Middleton out of the series, you would need – Giannis would have to average 35-plus in that one. And he could, especially if Robert Williams isn't back or he's trying to round himself back into form. But that's going to be tight. For Phoenix, because the 4-5 would be Dallas or Utah. And so, like, that seems a little – it seems more manageable than the Bucks side at the very least. We're trying to get Booker back. But again, that's a lot of looking ahead. There's a lot of games to be played, so I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. But that's just kind of where the thing goes for me right now.
All right. So let's say hypothetical world, since we're late in this pod, the Bucks and the Suns both go down in the first round. What's going to be shorter, your time spent on the Twitter app or the podcast that follows?
That's a good question. I think it'll be the pod by default. just because, like, I'll have the entire day to be on Twitter, and I'll be fighting for my life with the Chris's watching playoff games with me. And so I would have a lot less fun on the Twitter app, but I would be on the Twitter app. The pod is going to be an hour and a half, 2 hours, regardless, it feels like. So that's pretty static. But please, I hope injuries don't take those two teams out. Like, if my finals pick goes out the window in the first round, like, that's – I'm still going to be fine because basketball is great. But, you know, I'm going to get made fun of. That isn't going to be fun. It is what it is.
It's all right, man. Well, Dunkers, I have a Mr. Unreliable rant
in the tuck.
Probably not doing it tonight.
Boo.
We're at like two hours and 10 minutes.
Boo.
But let me know if you guys want it. And maybe we'll dust it off next pod.
There we go. The hashtag is Big Rant, folks. I did not...
The backstory, Nikias triggered me on the timeline. By just blatantly, you have to understand, there's trauma in life. And this man just went out and just retweeted the Mr. Unreliable headline from 2014 that the Oklahoman just blatantly put out on game day, game six in Memphis. Immediately triggered me.
It was not my intention to trigger you, sir. Like, someone tweeted that out. And I quote tweeted, like, that's the funniest reaction I've seen to a column.
No, there was nothing funny about that, man. I was folding laundry, about to take a nap on game day, happy as a clam. Sports Center on, sun is shining. Mr. Unreliable drops. Heart sinks, life changes. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Dunker Spot. You can find us on Twitter and stuff. I don't even remember. Jeez Louise.
Wherever you get your podcast, you could find us: Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. You could find me on Twitter at Nikias NBA. I think you can still find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. If you can't, then it's my fault. Just catch us in the Dunker Spot community. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Y'all forgot what Tony Allen and Tayshaun Prince did in 2014. I'm done.